This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later, we're going to be talking about the worldwide impact of El Nino. You know, it's not just a local thing. But first, the 2008 financial crisis, you remember that, I'm sure, if you had any money anywhere. It was one of the worst economic downturns since the Great Depression. And you would have thought that someone would have added up all the numbers and seen the meltdown coming. But the alarms flew past most experts in all areas. Even iconic Alan Greenspan said everyone missed it, from academia to the Fed. How can we build better financial forecasting tools? Well, a group of financial experts is looking to ecologists, rather than economists. Amy Nordstrom is here with that story and other selected shorts in science. She's a science writer for International Business Times here in New York. Welcome back.
Thank you, Ira. Good to be here.
Good to have you. So what's wrong with the economic models we have? I mean, they call it what? The dismal science, right?
So the traditional economic models that most of the world relies on right now basically distill all the behavior in an economy, all the things that you do and all the things that I do, down to what they call a rational actor, a single individual. You can think of it maybe in our case as the average American, who basically is a composite of all the different beliefs and attitudes and priorities that exist within a system. Of course, we know that the economy doesn't actually work that way. There's many different people acting on different beliefs at any given time. So a couple of economists made a proposal this week in a major scientific journal, Science, saying that we should really build out better economic models that are more representative of the diversity of beliefs that we see exist in the economy. And they're looking to, like you said, ecologists to do this. If you think of the economy, it's a system or a network made up of people, institutions like banks and companies, and federal regulators. And all of these different players interact with each other. They form relationships. And economists see a lot of parallels between that network and those that, for example, ecologists deal with. You can think of food webs in this case, where one species is highly dependent on the health of another. So their idea is that if they can adapt some of the rules that we know govern these other systems, if they can think more like ecologists or epidemiologists who track disease outbreaks in forming their economic models, they might actually be able to anticipate and understand economic phenomena better, such as the next financial crisis.
You know, it reminds me of how slime molds can make decisions.
Right.
So they're using that kind of biology.
So this entire idea is based in something called complexity theory, which is basically that complex systems, and that could be the ants in an anthill or the neurons in our brain, or in this case, the individual players in an economy, abide by a set of rules or organizing principles. And if you can just understand and identify these rules and track them over time, you can get an idea of what's going on and perhaps even see what's going to happen down the road. So they're hoping to apply this complexity theory to economics in the same way that, for example, weather forecasters have applied it to understanding our weather system, measuring things like atmospheric pressure, humidity, and then forecasting an oncoming storm.
Right. That'd be interesting to see how that works. Let's move on to your next story. And this is a study that came out looking at plant intelligence. We don't think of plants having brains or anything, do we?
They don't get enough credit, frankly. So Peter Crisp at Australian National University published a paper just today in Science Advances talking about memory and forgetfulness in plants. And scientists have known for a while that plants do have some capacity to form memories and to forget. So, for example, this often happens in times of stress. If there's a particularly dry period, a plant might shrivel up, and on its recovery, once it starts raining again, it may remember that period and choose not to grow quite as big, just in case there's another dry period around the corner. So he was interested in the fact that plants don't always do this. Sometimes they actually choose not to remember and grow back to their full size that they were before. He's trying to figure out basically, you know, when they remember and when they forget. And he's come up with this theory. He says that he thinks the advantage to remembering sometimes is not so great as the advantage to just forgetting and kind of throwing caution to the wind. So if the plant spends more resources actually adapting and preparing itself for that next dry period, it might just say, forget it. I'm going to go ahead and grow back to my full size, and I'll just take the chances that it's going to happen to me again. This is something that he considers an evolutionary advantage that plants have developed over time.
Yeah, because it's the last thing you think of is a plant having any memory or intelligence or thoughtfulness.
That's right. We're learning more about it all the time. It seems that they're able to make some sort of cost-benefit equation during that period of recovery, which is really interesting.
Let's talk about your freezer. I mean, my freezer, your freezer. You know, a lot of us keep TV dinners or popsicles in the freezer, and you have to clean out the freezer every now and then. And this story involves looking a group of scientists who, what, were they cleaning out their freezer like we do at home?
It does sound like that. So this is a group from Japan's National Institute of Polar Research, and they had a moss sample from Antarctica that had been in their freezer for 30 years.
You mean like somebody forgot it? It was sitting in the freezer?
So it was still there. It had been collected in from Antarctica, and they pulled it out.
Maybe when I was there, we took it out. I don't remember.
They pulled it out and they thawed it and they found two tardigrades, which are these bizarre organisms. They look a little bit like swollen caterpillars inside the moss sample. And they were really interested to see if these tardigrades, which had been frozen for 30 years, were capable of, were actually still alive and capable of reproducing. So once they thawed out the sample, the tardigrades, which had been completely frozen, did start to move after a period, and eventually one of them actually did go on to reproduce and laid 14 eggs that successfully hatched.
What are these bears? What do they call them?
They're also nicknamed moss piglets or water bears.
Water bears, right. We've done videos on tardigrades or the water bears. So well, let me understand this. They were frozen for 30 years. They defrosted them, and they came back to life?
That's right. So this is an example of what we call cryptobiosis. So the tardigrades are actually capable of surviving extreme circumstances, and they can basically dehydrate themselves and preserve their bodies. This protects them against some of the damage that happens to our cells if water freezes inside of us. So the tardigrades are capable of this, but they do not get the award for the longest period being frozen and able to come back to life. Roundworms actually hold that title at 39 years.
39 years.
Yes.
Now, I'm picturing the lab. I'm picturing you pulling this out. And you want to defrost it. Now, when you have a frozen dinner, you put it in the microwave. Did they do it that way? How do you defrost
tardigrades? It took a full day to actually defrost the moss sample. And then since the tardigrades were physically dehydrated, that's part of their strategy, they also had to sprinkle a little bit of water on them on day two so that they could absorb that water and come fully back to life.
Well, glad to have you back for these stories. Fascinating.
Thank you, Ira.
Amy Nordstrom is a science writer for the International Business Times here in New York. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. And if you're like many of us, your insurance plan, you know what that long piece of paper has, probably has a deductible. That's the amount you personally have to pay before the insurance coverage kicks in. I know what you know what I'm talking about. And there's a good chance those deductibles are increasing, leaving you to pay more out of your pocket. Sounds like a really bad, bad thing, right? Well, is there a good side to it? Here to talk us through the good and the bad of high deductible plans is Margot Sanger-Katz. She's a healthcare correspondent for the New York Times, and her article on this topic recently ran in the paper's Upshot column. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks so much for having me on.
What could possibly be good about having to pay a big deductible?
Well, it's never any fun. But the theory behind deductibles is that if all of your medical care is free, then there's no incentive for you to be prudent with how you spend your dollars. And so if everyone thinks everything is free, they might go to the most expensive hospital to get their treatment. They might get treatments that they don't really need or want just because why not? And the theory is that when people behave this way in aggregate, it drives up healthcare spending and it makes our premiums more expensive for everyone.
So if you have to pay a deductible, the idea is you'll shop around for the cheapest thing. I don't know how you shop around when you have to, you have an insurance company, but that's what the idea is.
Yeah, so that's the theory is that first of all, and there's actually pretty good evidence about this first thing, that people will just use less healthcare. That, if you're feeling a little crummy and it's going to cost you some money to go to the doctor, you might like wait a day and see if you feel better, and some of those people are going to feel better, and then there will be less doctor's visits. Whereas if it's totally free, you might just go to the doctor the second that you start feeling sick. And so there is evidence that when you ask people to pay for their healthcare with their own dollars, they use less healthcare. The question about shopping, I think there's sort of more hope than there is evidence so far that people will really look for better prices or, for good deals. Because as you said, it can be pretty hard actually to find this information, although more and more insurance companies and employers are trying to give people tools that can make it a little easier to comparison shop.
Well, that idea that how hard it is to do this, I'm thinking, a lot of people, and I know people who just give up, right? They don't go to the doctor anymore. because it's
And you know, there's evidence about this also. What they find, and this is one of the problems with deductibles, is people do cut back, but they don't necessarily cut back in a rational way. They sort of cut back on care that they don't need, and they also cut back on care that everyone agrees is actually really valuable, almost at the same rate.
Yeah, so how do you think this can play out better for consumers?
I think, you know, it's complicated. There definitely are some real downsides, but the real advocates for deductibles and for this idea of having people be more consumer-like in their use of healthcare is that we just have to really improve the transparency about the quality of healthcare, the value of it, and then also the price. And so if, you know, you hurt your knee and you have to get an MRI, and it's really easy to look around and see, like, here are the five best places in my neighborhood and here are the prices, that maybe then you actually would start to see people navigating towards those cheaper places. And then you might see some price pressure where the expensive place would say, like, oh, maybe I should charge less for this. But I don't think we're quite there yet.
So you think, like, maybe there'll be a website that, you know, you shop like you shop for a car or a hotel for the best site. I can see the commercials now.
Yeah.
You know? Guy comes on and say, we choose from all the MRI sites on the web. And you get to choose. But that seems to be something that might be good.
It could be good. And, you know, there are real advocates who feel like, you know, the healthcare economy is kind of really messed up because people don't behave like consumers the way that they do in other parts of our economy. On the other hand, you know, if you are in a terrible car accident and you're in an ambulance and you're unconscious on the way to the hospital, like, it doesn't matter how good the website is. You probably are just in no position either to pick the place that you go or to really make any judgment about what kind of medical care you need. If something's really wrong with you, most people just listen to what the doctor tells them.
Yeah, we're back at square one. All right. Margo, thank you very much. It's a very interesting topic. Margo Sanger-Katz is a healthcare correspondent for the New York Times. When we come back, we're going to talk about El Nino. You might think it's a local thing. Yeah, flooding, you know, here in the States, there are some, well, there's some dryness going on also. But it's really a global phenomenon affecting all kinds of places. We're going to talk about the impact it has all around the world. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. When you hear about El Nino in the news, the focus is usually on one thing.
The storms this past week are fueled by an El Nino.
We had our first really good soaking in
El Nino can bring
years.
Storms. That's what it's been doing.
Scientists have been doing forensic work to learn what set this huge storm in motion. They say they think the trail starts with the weathered pattern called El Nino.
Like in that clip, the focus of El Nino is usually storms and weird weather here in the United States. And hey, you can't blame people for paying attention to where they live. But El Nino is a truly global climate phenomenon, which affects all people all over the world. I was just down in Costa Rica, for example, where everyone was talking about the massive drought they're experiencing during this El Nino cycle. And that's, of course, a flip side to all that rain in California. And El Nino's atmospheric influence stretches all the way through South America, over to Africa, even Southeast Asia. So this hour, we wanted to take stock of what El Nino means, depending on your place on the planet. And if you're unsure what exactly El Nino is or why it even comes and goes, we're going to start off with a little refresher course from Andy Hoyle. He's a NOAA meteorologist at the Earth System Research's Laboratory Physical Science Division in Boulder, Colorado. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Hoyle.
Hi, Ira. Thank you very much.
Let's start with El Nino. What's the thumbnail definition? Give us a little background.
Sure. El Nino is one phase of the El Nino Southern Oscillation. The El Nino Southern Oscillation is characterized by a shift in warm water across the tropical Pacific Ocean and the associated winds alongside that. During El Nino, warm water from the West Pacific Ocean shifts eastward toward the Central Pacific Ocean, so the normally cool Central and Eastern tropical Pacific Ocean become anomalously warm. Some El Nino events are well predicted. This El Nino is a good example of that. On the other hand, some El Nino events are poorly predicted, and the forecast El Nino of last winter that didn't materialize until March is another good example. This shows that as a scientific community, we have a lot to learn about the physics of El Nino. Currently, we're learning a lot more about the physics of El Nino through NOAA's El Nino Rapid Response Field Campaign. And our Rapid Response Field Campaign is taking observations of the tropical Pacific using various assets that include airplanes, ships, buoys, satellites, and models.
Does it extend up and down the whole America's coastline, North, South America?
The expression of El Nino is typically tropically confined, but with the global impacts, so El Nino, even though it's characterized by changes in sea surface temperatures and those associated winds over the tropics, we see big changes in the tropical climate that then influence the rest of the climate. So you can think of it like this. So when we see an El Nino event like we're having right now, we get precipitation, enhanced precipitation over the tropical Central Pacific Ocean. And the effect of the enhanced tropical Pacific Ocean precipitation causes the formation of clouds and therefore rainfall, and that releases a lot of energy to the atmosphere. So that energy release to the atmosphere, it behaves similar to dropping a stone in water. And what that does is it creates waves that then move away from the source of that stone moving in the water. Mm-hmm. And that's what we see here in our climate system. And we see these waves move away in a somewhat of a predictable way.
Do we know why? Why El Niños begin and end?
We have hypotheses that to constrain that, but we have a lot more to learn, obviously, in terms of the way El Niños begin and then mature. And that it's very difficult. We have a hypothesis called the delayed oscillator hypothesis that needs to be further explored.
Do we have any connection to global warming?
It's interesting. There have been a number of studies in the last couple of years, and these studies focus on two things. The first one is that it looks at how the El Niño itself behaves under global warming. And there's increasing evidence that there are more El Niño and La Niña extremes associated with that. La Niña is just the opposing phase of El Niño within the ENSO cycle. There's also another complicating factor here is the background climate is changing as well. So the Pacific sea surface temperatures are generally warming, and alongside that associated with El Niño, we see enhanced impacts, and we've actually seen that during the recent La Niñas. So there's a lot more that we need to learn in terms of how the global warming effect is impacting El Niño.
Thank you for that primer, Andy. It was highly educational. Andy Hoyle is a NOAA meteorologist and at the Earth System Research Laboratory's Physical Sciences Division in Boulder, Colorado. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ira.
You're welcome. Okay, now that we know the ABCs of El Niño, we can delve into its consequences around the world with a couple of scientists who study El Niño effects on people, making or breaking a year's harvest, flooding coastal cities, or maybe driving a bumper crop of disease-carrying mosquitoes. Madeline Thompson is a senior research scientist at the International Research Institute for Climate and Sociology in Palisades, New York, and director of the WHO Collaborating Center on Climate-Sensitive Diseases. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much.
Aaron Bernstein is associate director of the Center for Health and the Global Environment at Harvard. Welcome to Science Friday. Dr. Thompson, let me ask you, give us a snapshot of some of the things happening in other parts of the world now due to El Niño.
Well, the El Niño emerged for 2015 in May last year, and it has been impacting on the climate, particularly on the tropical climates, since then, according to the timing of their rainy seasons. And more generally, the impact on temperature been persisting throughout the year. And while we still have a strong El Niño going at the moment, we expect that to dissipate in the next few months. But the impacts on health and on communities around the world will continue way beyond that, just because of the way that climate impacts on society, impacts on food security, and impacts on vector-borne diseases with a certain amount of delay sometimes.
You know, it sounds almost surprising that an El Niño can go all the way over to Africa, affect malaria there, or the Rift Valley fever in East Africa, fires in Indonesia. It's amazing something so far away can have such a ripple effect.
It is extraordinary, and I'm coming from the non-climate background. It's been something that's been a fascinating journey for me to understand the importance of El Niño in driving health issues around the world. And I think in the last decade, the health community has started to understand that it's important to be able to factor in El Niño and other climate issues into health preparedness, really trying to make sure that control programs are well organized in time to deal with unusual events like this.
Aaron Bernstein, some studies have linked El Niño to cholera cases in Bangladesh. Is that right?
Where was it?
Aaron Bernstein, can you hear me? Oh, I guess he's having trouble hearing me. Aaron Bernstein, are you there? Oh, let me continue with Madeline while we get him squared away.
Can you hear me now?
I hear you. Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. Magic of live radio. Let me ask you about the possibility that I understand that El Nino may be linked to cholera cases in Bangladesh. What's going on there?
Sure. So dating back a few decades now, starting with some of Rita Colwell's work, there was a suspicion that temperatures in the Bay of Bengal, which is near Bangladesh, would drive the likelihood of cholera. And over time, that hypothesis has been explored. And it seems from experience that cholera outbreaks are more likely to occur and in El Nino years. And that's perhaps not surprising because those cholera epidemics in part are driven by the what are called copepod populations. These are small animals living in the ocean that harbor the bacteria. And they do quite well in warmer waters.
Mm-hmm. There was a story in the New York Times the other day about the dengue outbreak in Argentina. Any possible links to El Nino?
Yeah, so there is research also showing that dengue outbreaks are more common in Argentina during El Nino years. And so it's not terribly surprising to hear about that outbreak.
Couldn't we link it to the outbreak now in the Zika virus?
Well, you know, the same mosquito transmits Zika and dengue. So those mosquitoes are likely benefiting from El Nino conditions. Now, the presence of Zika in South America itself is a separate question because it's obviously new to that continent.
Madeline Thompson, do developing countries have access to all this data and analyses that the developed countries have about El Nino and the spreading of disease?
No, they clearly don't. But I think one of the opportunities, if you like, created by El Nino is that it substantially influences the climate in the tropics, and it makes that climate more predictable. So populations in the tropics often are poorer and more vulnerable to climate events and more exposed, if you like, to infectious disease, etc. But forecasts of the future climate, the season ahead, work better in the tropics because of El Nino. So you've got a sort of an advantage for poorer countries there as long as that information can be made available. And that information increasingly is being made available to affected countries. Ethiopia, I think, is an excellent example where the government really understands how important climate is, not only to its economy and its livelihoods, but to disease issues, etc., and the development of epidemics. And they have been working very hard with their meteorological services to get the predictions ahead of time, position resources ahead of events to try and alleviate the issues for the population. So I think that is really beginning to develop now.
Aaron Bernstein, you've talked about using El Nino as a sort of real-world experiment that gives us hints about what might happen under climate change.
Sure, yeah. I think that El Nino events, because they have such profound effects upon temperature and precipitation around the world, may give us a glimpse as to the kinds of risks for infectious diseases we might see in a warmer world with more intense precipitation cycles. And I can't say that the kinds of patterns we see with infectious diseases during El Nino years are the kinds of patterns we'll see as climate change unfolds. But what El Nino teaches us is that the diseases of humanity and many of the ones we've talked about are climate sensitive. And we cannot expect that as climate change continues to unfold, that we're not going to see nasty surprises of infectious diseases.
Mm-hmm. How much money do we in the U.S. government spend annually on studying El Nino? Is there a ballpark estimate of what percentage of the budget or the weather budget or the climate budget?
I think that there's the piece which is the natural science piece, which is substantial. But the other question is, do we understand the health pathways? And funding into the effects of climate change into health is really quite limited right now. You know, in the NIH, for instance, which has a $32 billion budget, at best, there's probably $160 million or so, which would be less than a percent of the budget. EPA throws in another fair share. But the truth is that we can do a lot more to prepare the people we depend upon to protect us from potential nasty surprises by having more funding available to both understand and prepare for potential outbreaks.
I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking about the health effects of El Nino. You know, one scientist after another comes on this program and tells us, you know, we only react after there's an emergency. We don't spend any money really researching whether it's, you know, the Zika virus or whether it's any other kind of disease that strikes until we're hit over the head with it. Would you agree with that?
You know, I think we have a habit as a species of being reactionary, but I've actually seen a lot that suggests we're learning a different way of behaving with this stuff. I mean, we now have plans in place to do better when it comes to the drought we're seeing in Ethiopia, to floods we're seeing elsewhere in the world, and trying to position aid in places that will offset potential humanitarian problems. Now, we can obviously do more, but I'm heartened to see that we acknowledge that this is a real issue and that we can anticipate problems. And I see that trend continuing. I think that you know, aid organizations and governments have really understood that we can do a lot to lessen the potential health burden here.
Madeline, do you agree with that?
Well, yes, and I think the other issue is that it's to really understand the value of systematic data collection. You can't predict the future climate without understanding the past. You can't enable new tools for predicting epidemics if people haven't got good data to work with. And I think understanding the investments in health information systems, in climate data, et cetera, the importance of those investments for being able to manage risk is something that I think the public is beginning to understand, and I think we need to make politicians understand that too.
Let me see if I can get a quick phone call in here. Let's go to Hans in the, is it Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin?
That's correct.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. Sorry, it's not really a health question, but I was just curious about, given where El Nino tends to start in the Pacific Ocean, if it has any sort of effect on the Hawaiian Islands and or if it sort of passes over them.
Aaron, do you see any health effects? Or?
You know, I haven't come across evidence to show that, but I'm not sure anyone's looked particularly closely.
Mm-hmm. And Madeline, I'm sure you probably haven't either.
Well, I think that we, certainly in the institute where I work, where we have climate scientists who've worked in the Pacific, very much so, I think that it's likely that there's predictability there. In fact, I know there's a climate institute in Hawaii that's focused very much on ENSO. So they must have a strong effect there, too.
I got about a minute before the break, but I want to talk about the flip side to El Nino, La Nina. Does that cancel out some of El Nino's negative effects around the world? Madeline?
It creates not exactly opposite conditions. I think the main thing about both La Nina and El Nino is that they create unusually sort of departures from the average, if you like. So right. Either wetter conditions from normal or drier conditions from normal. And any disruption or change like that tends overall to have a negative effect because economies, livelihoods, agricultural systems, if you like, are established around norms. And when you have an unusual situation, it's more difficult to manage.
Yeah. Talking with Madeline Thompson, in case you're just joining us, from the World Health Organization, Aaron Bernstein from Harvard, the Director of Center for Health and Global Environment at Harvard. Our number, 844-724-8255, if you'd like to call in and talk about El Nino and its world effects. So you can also tweet us at SciFry. We're taking tweets also. We have to take a break, but we will be right back, so stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about El Nino, where you know a lot of people think it's a lot of rain in California or a dry desert some other place in the United States, but it is a worldwide effect, and it's hard to believe how far around the world it affects disease and food security And I'm discussing that with my guests, Madeline Thompson, senior research scientist at the International Research Institute for Climate and Society in Palisades, New York, a little bit up the Hudson here. Aaron Bernstein, associate director of the Center for Health and the Global Environment at Harvard. Our number, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Aaron, is El Nino going to get even stronger due to climate change or global warming?
Well, I think as we heard from Dr. Hoyle, that there is some evidence to suggest that climate change may be influencing the strength of El Niños. That evidence is fairly preliminary. But as a pediatrician, as a clinician, I look at this situation as I would a young child in my care who had a fever and was looking fairly sick, and saying it's not really the wise choice to sort of watch and wait and see what happens. I would want to try and understand as best I could and intervene if I knew how to intervene appropriately. And, you know, that's what we see here. We see potential catastrophes that are avoidable, and we know how to fix them. You know, in medicine, we have problems that we can understand fully. We know very well how they manifest, but we have no means to treat them. That's not the problem of climate change. And if climate change is influencing El Niños, which we know disrupt health systems and substantially harm people around the world, we really need to make sure we're doing everything possible to prevent those harms.
Would I take that to mean, infer from what you're saying, by treatment that is decreasing carbon emissions?
That's right. I think that there's no question that what the doctor orders in this instance is reducing our greenhouse gas contributions to the Earth's atmosphere.
Madeline, is there a general agreement about that around the world?
Yes. And but one of the things I'd like to add is even, you know, with the uncertainty or maybe, you know, sort of like understanding of climate change impact on the El Niños themselves, we know that it impacts on the actual impacts. And that is because if you have a drought in a warming world, then that drought is going to be more severe than in a cooler environment because of the increased evapotranspiration. So we know that even without changes in El Niño, a warming world is going to increase the impacts. And then, like has already been raised, you know, there are questions that these events may become more and more severe. I think if you remember in the COP21, the big conference in Paris for the climate treaty, there were a very significant presence from the health community at that conference, trying to ensure that health is really clearly understood as a major area of harm of climate change, but also area of benefit for climate change mitigation. Because if we reduce carbon emissions, we know absolutely we can save lives, reduce asthma, all those other health problems that are associated with poor quality air.
We had a question before from a listener about Hawaii, but we now have a listener from Hawaii who's calling in from Maui. Hi, Tom. Welcome.
Hi.
Give us an update on what you've experienced.
Yeah, so this past summer, I surf a lot, and the water temperature here this summer was warmest I've ever or felt it, and it lasted pretty far into the fall and into winter. And on top of that, really light winds, which makes great surf conditions, as well as a lot of swells coming from both the south and the north. So, you know, that's something that we experienced from the last El Nino over here in Maui, and I'm sure on the rest of the island.
So that's kind of a good thing for surfers, then.
Definitely, yeah. We have a very positive impact as far as the surfing. I think the rainfall can be a lot lighter than normal.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there is a little bit of a thanks for calling, Tom, and calling, giving us a surf report about El Nino. I guess those bigger waves, it's a little warmer. And there is some effect on Hawaii, but we don't know what the effect. He didn't give us. He said it was a little drier. Would that?
Yeah.
Would that be about that right, Madeline?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's. I think it is surprising to people here in the States, him talking from Hawaii, that it is very surprising to people. For example, we had a tweet in, somebody was asking, we don't have any monsoons here in the U.S. What kind of monsoons are you talking about?
Oh, I was talking about in the Sahel, in Africa, and the Indian monsoon.
Mm-hmm. And where does that stand now?
What are the current?
Yeah, are they getting more intense, or can you predict that they will be?
So at the moment, the monsoon for West Africa is over. Mm-hmm. It's their dry season. Yeah, and but we do know that El Nino does impact on the timing, the intensity of the rainy season, and in parts of the world, the rainy season is governed by monsoons.
Well, so. let me ask this question, and in summing up, what don't we know about El Nino that you, as a worldwide planner, would like to know more about? What do we need to know?
For me, the challenge is that we need to know really how it's going to impact locally, because decisions about how to manage health issues are taken at many different levels, at the global level, regional level, national level, but at the local level is really where the rubber hits the road. And people need to understand their climate locally, how it's influenced by factors such as El Nino, and may be influenced in the future by climate change. And to have that local information, you have to be able to have local data that is managed and available to decision makers. And that, I think, is a big gap in many countries. It's a gap that we're trying to fill. But it's a very important starting point to understand your local climate and understand its drivers.
Aaron Bernstein, you agree?
Absolutely. And I think it's critical to underscore that El Niños have been happening as long as probably humans have been around, and certainly longer. And what's changing is the climate around us. And so we know that there will be surprises during El Niños, but we're making the health of people potentially at greater risk as climate change unfolds, because as was mentioned, whenever an El Nino happens, it's happening in the context of the existing climate. And I think it's just crucial to underscore that if we do what's necessary to mitigate climate change, to address climate change, we're likely to achieve the greatest public health victory in history, bigger than vaccines, bigger than sanitation, bigger than antibiotics, because so much is at stake for people's health. And El Nino just amplifies that risk. So I just think it's crucial that we have to understand we have this opportunity in our grasp. And I'm heartened to see the international community at the Paris conference acknowledge that we have to take action. And as a pediatrician in particular, as someone whose career has been dedicated to the welfare of children, I couldn't be happier to see that, because not only are children more vulnerable to the harms we're talking about, the droughts, the floods, the famines, but they're going to grow up in this world, and we really do owe it to them to do everything we can to ensure the healthiest mm-hmm. possible future.
All right, then we'll have to leave it at that. Aaron Bernstein, Associate Director of the Center for Health and the Global Environment at Harvard. Madeline Thompson, Senior Research Scientist at the International Research Institute for Climate and Society in Palisades. She's also the director of the World Health Organization Collaborating Center on Climate-Sensitive Diseases. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks, Sarah.
You're welcome. The World Health Organization says that malnutrition is a contributing factor in more than one-third of all child deaths worldwide. And lack of access to safe and healthy food is certainly a major part of malnutrition. But research out this week in the journal Science says that food access may not be the only player. There may be a role for the microbiome, what else, as well. Jeffrey Gordon is a professor at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis and one of the authors on that paper. Welcome to Science Friday.
So nice to be here.
Thank you. Walk us through how you know that the microbiome plays a role in malnutrition.
Well, let's go back to some studies about what we can do with malnutrition and what we haven't been able to do. We know that this set of disorders is not due to food insecurity alone, as you pointed out. We also know that there's been a dramatic advance in reducing mortality with the treatment of children, particularly with severe malnutrition, with these so-called ready-to-use therapeutic foods. And although mortality is reduced, some of the long-term consequences of malnutrition, persistent stunting, neurodevelopmental abnormalities, impaired immune responses, including to vaccinations, those haven't really been effectively treated. So we're missing something. And what might that be? Most of us think about human development from the perspective of our human cells and organs. We were curious to think about another dimension to our development, and that involves our microbial communities, particularly the largest such community that lives inside of us, our gut microbiota. 2 years ago, we studied a group of children, members of a birth cohort, living in Bangladesh, a group that had healthy growth, and those that developed severe undernutrition. And what we found was there is a program of development of this microbial organ that occurs in healthy individuals that can be characterized by the appearance and relative representation of a group of bacterial strains. And that provides a measurement tool to see whether this organ is developing normally in children with malnutrition. What was found then in that cohort of children was that those who have severe acute malnutrition have impaired development of this organ. They have a microbial community that appears younger than what you would expect based on their chronological ages. Equally importantly, when these children are treated with these ready-to-use therapeutic foods, there is a partial but only transient improvement in this immaturity. So what happens is that these children have a persistent developmental abnormality affecting this organ. We asked, could this be a causal factor in malnutrition, or was it simply an effect of malnutrition? And what could we do to repair this immaturity, and what effect might it be on healthy growth?
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking with Jeffrey Gordon. So you found direct evidence, did you, that if you there is a connection between a malnourished child and an unhealthy microbiome?
Well, we made those observations about immaturity of the gut microbiota in Bangladesh.
Mm-hmm.
So we traveled from South Asia to East Africa, to Malawi, and asked a couple of questions. First, is this program of normal development of the microbiota shared across populations that have very different cultural and culinary traditions? And this would be in healthy children. And the answer was yes. Same features, many of the same features in terms of which microbes were appearing when during the first couple of years of life were evident in healthy Malawian children, just as they were in healthy Bangladeshi children. And as in Bangladesh, we saw that children who were malnourished had impaired development, this microbiota immaturity. But again, the question is, effect or cause? So a very talented graduate student in the lab rolled up her sleeves and did a series of organ transplants. In this case, the organ is a microbial organ. And the transplants involve taking a microbial community from children from Malawi who had healthy growth and children who were severely stunted and underweight. She took these communities and implanted them into the guts of mice that had been reared under sterile conditions, who were fed a diet similar to those consumed by the children in Malawi. When she transplanted healthy communities that were maturing normally, the animals grew very well. Muscle mass increase, bone growth, metabolism in multiple organs. But when those microbial communities were from stunted, underweight children, when they had this immaturity, the recipient mice had growth faltering. Even though all groups of mice were consuming the same amount of this Malawian diet. So the same food, the same amount, but a different microbial community.
How hard would it be to try this out in children? I mean, you're not feeding them anything You know, I understand from the research that just the mice being around the other mice had sort of transferred the good bacteria to them.
Well, what are the actors that we want to feed? Can we focus our attention on those organisms that are actually the agents that promote growth? And that was another and important part of the story. So a variety of different methods were used to find a group of these age-discriminatory organisms that form part of the signature by which we judge the development of this microbial organ and identify
I'm running out of time, so I have to ask you, did you identify something and could you use it?
Yes, we did identify them, and they become the targets of new types of foods that will sponsor their adequate representation and expression of the functions that they need to express that promote growth.
And are you going to try it out on the kids?
Yes, we're moving forward in the coming years to test this new type of microbiota-directed foods that are directed at these organisms that we think are instrumental in promoting healthy growth.
One last quick question. What strain of bacteria did you identify?
It's not just one, Ira. No. There are an ensemble of these organisms that are important.
We'll have to pick this up because we've run out of time, but it's interesting. Another microbiome success. Jeffrey Gordon, professor at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. One last thing. If you've been listening, you know we like stories about food, and I'm especially fond of cheese. So we've got good news for those of you in and around New York. An evening of cheese science. We're going to be working with the folks at Famous Murray's Cheese to host an evening celebrating the science of cheese. You can also get a cheesy video premiere with Luke Raskin. We got an assortment of cheeses for tasting and, of course, wine pairings. So if you're there, I'll be hogging the cheese. So get there early. You can find out and get tickets at scifry.me/cheesenight. Come and sample cheese and wine with us, scifry.me/cheesenight. Looking forward to seeing you.